Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu,
with a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening. Our reading this morning comes from Genesis chapter 25, verses 19 through 34. These are the descendants of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padam Aram, sister of Laban, the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and his wife Rebekah conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is to be this way, why do I live?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The elder shall serve the younger." When her time to give birth was at hand, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy mantle, so they named him Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand gripping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, living in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking a stew, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of the red stuff, for I am famished." Therefore he was called Edom. Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright." Esau said, "I am about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" And Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright.
Walking down the street of dreams, eating from the fruit of life, tripping out on the smallest things, trying to reach the light, trying to reach the light.
The World Cup this afternoon, he will not be playing in it. Can you show us that first image there? Anybody know who that is? Where's Pierre? Pierre knows who that. Who else? Yes, who is that? It's Robin. Is that how we say it? Iron Robin from the Netherlands. He is a forward for the Netherlands, and he single-handedly made it almost impossible for me to watch the Netherlands play in the World Cup, because what he's doing right there happens incessantly when he is on the pitch, as they call it, on the soccer field. He is notorious for diving. He does it all the time. And I am not a soccer player, so when I look on at what's happening, I think it's deceptive, and it ruins the game, and can't we figure this out? Like, can't somebody come up with a better system so that people aren't just flopping all around all the time? It does not make sense to me why someone would want to do this. The Washington Post had an online article this week, and they called it, "So You Think You Can Flop?" And each flop that they had a series of expert football players talk about whether this was a foul or a flop. And it goes through them and you can read their analysis, but I appreciated this. They write, "Whether it's a dramatic fall, an open mouth shriek, or a prolonged roll on the ground, having the theatrical ability to convince a referee of an opponent's foul is part of an effective soccer strategy." Dang. Aaron Robin is an effective soccer player, like one of the most effective, one of the best in the world. He's a trickster in every sense of the word. And he does this, he flops and he dives, all for the benefit of his team. But there's always an edge to it. Like, when's it going to happen and what's the significance of it? He's a trickster. Marian Grau is a professor over in Berkeley. She introduced me to the concept of the trickster during a class that I was taking called Of Divine Economy. So I've been living in her writing this week, and unlike the other people that we've been focusing on, Marian will actually listen to this, so it makes it a little bit more intimidating to talk about how she would talk about something, because she'll let me know the various places where, oops, I dove and I should have not. She's, it's not light summer reading when you sit down with Of Divine Economy. It's the farthest thing from it, so I'm going to do my best to put it before us in a way that I hope helps us shed some light on ways that God might be moving in our lives and in the world. She is an important voice, and she also happens to be from Germany. And so you can think about it yourself, like, did we actually know that Germany would be in the finals? Or maybe we worked this out with FIFA. In week one of this series, we talked about how corrupt they were. So maybe they aligned everything and Brazil tanked 7-1 because we were going to talk about Germany. And it makes way more sense to talk about a German theologian when Germany is in the finals this morning. Well, in about an hour and a half, 2 hours from now. I'll let you hold how that happened, whether we tricked or just got lucky. We did wonder about maybe Germany could do it. When I originally encountered this notion of the trickster, I was quite convinced that there was nothing redeemable about a trickster. It was kind of like I saw diving in soccer, like, ugh, there is nothing about that that could be positive. It was all negative. It was harmful. And Marian Grau invited me to rethink my notions of a trickster and invited me to wonder and to hold, what about how God and faith might engage this as well? And things started to turn upside down, so this might do some of that for you this morning as well. I want to start, though, with the traditional interpretation of what we heard from Genesis chapter 25. A traditional interpretation of this would say that Jacob and Esau, well, they're less than flattering people. They're a mess, actually. Their lives are chaos. And this story is just about that. It's about how messy their lives are. And God is with them in the mess. Like, that's the good news on one reading of this story. So it starts in 25 with Jacob conning his brother Esau out of his birthright as the firstborn. So in our day, my younger brother thinks that I got a lot of advantages because I was the firstborn, and there maybe were some, but in their day, this is huge. Like, we can't overstate how big the deal was to be the elder son, okay? Wealth went with this. Land went with this. All of these privileges were very, very real. And so Jacob tricks Esau into giving that advantage, that privilege over to him. And then in what follows, Jacob works with his mom to cruelly deceive his older brother and his old father who's also blind. They deceive his older father, and he again comes out on top by getting through trickery and deceit his father's blessing. So this is a story that's all deceit all over the place. The traditional reading is that's the people. They're a mess, but God is with them. And it goes something like this. One biblical scholar says that the action of Rebekah and Jacob was utterly discreditable and indefensible is, of course, obvious. And this morning, we're going to pause to ask the audacious question of, was it? Like, was it really? Was it really indefensible? Because if it was, why does it seem that God is involved in the decision the whole time? Now, it's one thing to say Jacob or Rebekah is a trickster. There are some liberative things about that. Like if you read the story and you see Esau, Esau is the masculine one who is out in the field doing the work, and Jacob is the one who's loved by his mother. There's some really creative ways you can say the one who comes out on top in this story is the one who transgresses gendered norms. That's kind of an interesting read on this story. But it's one thing to talk about their trickery. It's another to talk, though, about God's involvement in that deception. But if you spend enough time with this story, it becomes pretty clear as you read Genesis that that indeed seems to be the case. God is involved in this trickery as well. So our question this morning is, what are we going to do with that? What are we going to do with that? Is there anything redeemable about this story? David Carr, who is a professor of mine out in New York City, he writes about it as this story was redacted. It was like passed down from people to other folks. And so it got edited over time. And you see in the editing that sometimes the trickster would get edited out, the trickery would, the deception. Like, we don't want to actually pose God looking quite like that. Let's change this up a little bit. So even in that, though, he says, the trickster has not been completely tamed. As a result, the reader is left with the task of making sense out of a subversive Jacob on the one hand, and Jacob, the divinely supported and morally justified ancestor of Israel, on the other. So this unabashed trickster and God's preference. How are we going to hold those in tension? What are we going to do about that? I'm going to take a moment to spend a little time with this story. And a book called Jacob and the Divine Trickster helped me to think about this week. So Genesis 25 to 28, if you read through these three chapters, you move from womb all the way to Bethel, and you'll see Jacob's life progress, and you'll see all the ways that he deceives people around him. But the whole story is really rooted on this. This is when Rebecca, who is barren, is longing for God to help her have a child, and so she prays, she goes to God, and this is what God says to her. Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. And the way it traditionally gets interpreted is the older shall serve the younger. So it's like God is telling her, you should really like Jacob. You should really like Jacob. And it's kind of affirming that. But when you actually look more deeply at the Hebrew, other scholars would say that the way this should be translated is the greater shall serve the lesser. Well, older and younger, they're very specific in the story about who came out first. It's a big deal. Jacob actually gets named heel because he's grabbing the heel of the person. That's what Jacob meant. So who came out first was clear. But who's greater and who's lesser at this point in the story? It's really ambiguous. So if you hold the actual Hebrew in that way, what I believe we're left with is a God who gives this ambiguous blessing, and then Rebecca has to try to figure out, what am I going to do with this? That's very different than aligning Rebecca up because she heard God say the other, correct? It's a very different way. And as you keep going in just a couple of chapters from here, it's not just the ambiguity that God instills in this story, but it's an actual blessing. You see this long blessing. Let's see the next slide, Ryan. This is toward the end of chapter 28. And what you find here, as the screen goes, that's just how my whole weekend's been going. Do you see how the screen flinted like that? Like my daughter was up all night sick and my wife's delivering a baby. This whole thing has just been, don't ever preach on being a trickster because God will use it against you in the middle of worship. So this is what's happening in Genesis 28 is that God is blessing Jacob in this moment. God is not outside of these events. It becomes explicit as God moves from behind the scenes to the fore at Bethel, where instead of rejecting Jacob for his trickery and his deceit, God actually affirms the birthright and the blessing that Jacob deceived his way into. So I want to pause for a second, because my guess is, for some of us at least, thinking about God as a trickster is unsettling. We're not quite sure where to go with that. At least I'm not all the time. You might even think I'm a little bit delusional standing here. I stayed awake too late with that four-year-old. But throughout Christian history, people who have longed to root their lives in grace and grow in faith and reach in love have been so compelled by this image of God's trickery that they have themselves led lives of such deception in the name of God as well, in liberative ways. So I want to introduce us to a couple of them this morning. One person in late antiquity who uses deception and trickery, his name is Abba Simeon. So he's a father. Abba just means daddy, a father. He's a monk. He entered the city where he was going. How would you imagine a monk entering a city? I don't know, like in monk garb or something like that. So he had that, but he also dragged behind him a dead dog by one leg. Okay, that's weird, right? Got people's attention. And then he walked into worship with the dog. And afterwards, the hospitality tables, as we think about them out there, were there. And he dumped them over. And then he walked off. He was known for stopping people in the middle of the street and throwing things at them. This is a delusional, crazy person who becomes known as Simeon the Holy Fool. He took things that we assume to be normal and he turned them upside down to make people pause and think and wonder. You might not like these tactics, but this was a person who longed to follow in the way of Jesus and did so by acting a fool. But you'd only know he was acting if you read the one person who records his life to tell you that all of this was a facade to turn the world upside down, to make people question, was what was real, really real, right in front of them? I'm not trying to convince you that the way of the trickster is the only way, but it does seem to me to be worthy of taking note and wondering about how God might be alive through subversion and even trickery. There's another person in our day. His name is Reverend Billy. Has anybody seen Reverend Billy before? That's his gospel choir of Stop Shopping. They set up mostly during the Christmas season, but at any moment, they'll show up at Walmart and they will exorcise the demon of consumerism in the middle of the space, in the middle of the store. And he like takes the role of reverend to its nth degree to draw attention to the ways in which we make consumption a religion. And then he says, stop shopping. And he has a choir that sings and they do all of these things. There is a lot of deception and subversiveness to the ways in which he lives and moves. And a lot of people would say he's just simply a fool. Some would say he's a holy fool. He's actually a devout Episcopalian. His name is Bill Tallon. Marianne Grau was with him this time last year, and she was most amazed that when they got out of worship together, they served communion to people together, and then they walked down the street, and he's kind of followed around by a band of young punks with crazy hair and lots of tattoos. And she was amazed at the way in which his own life was lived out in ministry in these ways. So whether you agree or disagree with those particular forms of activism, he is one of the most compelling to me tricksters of our time, who takes religion and just flips it around to make us wonder and think. So is all that trickery too far removed from what Jacob did, from the way that Jacob deceived his brother? I'm not sure. See, Jacob and Rebekah, they certainly plotted their own deceptions to invert and subvert the status quo of their day. And to be clear for a moment, Jacob is a person, and he is also the people of Israel. So when In late antiquity, when Jews heard this story, or even to this day, what we hear is Jacob is us as a Jewish people. That's who this is. So his deceptive ways, then, are the ways of the people of God, the ways that are blessed by God. So in that level, God then is redeeming God's people through Jacob, through this subversive redemption is the way we would talk about it within the Christian tradition. Redemption is being forgiven for our sins, being delivered from the ways in which we fall short. That's how we talk about it as followers of Jesus. And for us, redemption turns around Jesus Christ. And my guess is many of us, maybe all of us, have no idea that the word redemption that we talk about within Christianity also has some of the same subversive economic tones that we heard in what happened with Reverend Billy. This was new to me. See, contemporary Christians use the term redemption, Marian Grau writes, and we're often oblivious to the economic undertones that early Christian interpretations of the work of Christ, yet they're hard to ignore. Upon further investigation, the motif of redemption proves to be deeply, if uncomfortably, she says, embodied in the symbolism of economic deal-making. The English word redemption, it's derived from the term purchase. Redeeming signifies an action of buying back or recovering. The word ransom signifies the action of procuring the release of a prisoner. That's what ransoming is. So when Jacob is ransoming for his brother for the birthright, he's exchanging stew for all the land and wealth of his dad. That's a pretty good exchange. Sweet deal. He makes out on the other side. Is it possible, though, that we could read the person, the redemption of Jesus Christ in some of those similar subversive ways? So Matthew 20, 28 says this. Just as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. So traditional ways that the church has dealt with this, stay with me for a second, everybody here. Traditional ways that the church has dealt with this is that God has ransomed God's only Son, Jesus, for our sins. We are free because Jesus' life has been taken on the cross. That's a traditional interpretation. It's called atonement, substitutionary atonement, like God puts Jesus to substitute for our sins. That comes after Anselm, but there's hundreds of years where that's actually not the dominant way that Christians thought about what the death of Jesus actually signifies was. So we're going to take a moment and kind of look for a second at a little bit of that and wonder. Marian Grau actually pushes really hard on this because she says that if we give too much interpretation to one, or too much space to one interpretation, we close God off, we confine God. We don't allow the nuance and the depth and the wonder of these stories, the mess of these stories, to actually mess with our own oppressive readings. So what if redemption bought by God was something very, very subversive? See, the way this one actually gets turned is Jesus suffered on the cross, so therefore you're called to suffer as well. And that's been used to oppress people throughout the centuries. We think of enslavement. Well, God calls people to suffering, so that is a way that that has been justified and was justified for far, far, far too long. Suffering is simply what Jesus did, so we too must do that. But what if the reading was much, much more subversive? One ancient reading, for example, says something like this. That you have God and you have a devil. And to our day, some of us tune out right there because we don't think of a devil as a being, right? So we just stop at that moment. But in late antiquity, if you use their framework, you have God and you have a devil. And God comes in the form of Jesus, puts on camouflage. God is God, but puts on human flesh, camouflages God's self. And then Jesus wonders, well, the devil wonders, I have evil power over everyone, even that one. So God says, well, let's make a deal. You can try to pull that one into your ways, Jesus, the one that's God camouflaged, and if you win, you win. And so the devil, who is longing for more power and greed, makes this deal, this ransom. They ransom Jesus. But God, camouflage, destroys that and breaks free. And what if that's the moment of redemption, of liberation? This is the way that we try to reread something that's been used to cause suffering, to say maybe there was something really subversive about the way that God was acting. Maybe God was a trickster in that moment too. And in that very moment, there was trickery that was going on. This version of ransom, as it's talked about in Matthew 28, go back to that one for me, Ryan. This version of Jesus being a ransom in Matthew 20:28 is best understood when we think about and when we understand the ways in which slavery was assumed in Jesus' day, okay? So in Matthew's Jesus, the people are living in a time of Roman Empire, and they know top-down hierarchies. They know what top-down hierarchy looks like and what it is. But Jesus doesn't encourage his followers to vie for positions of power at the top. Instead, Jesus says, become like I am. Become enslaved like this. That is the way Jesus maps power, by calling those around him to two ways of being. One is to subvert all of the hierarchies and to be lesser, or to be as Jesus is, a slave who emerges as an agent of liberation. That's what God does when God chooses to give up omnipotence, omniscience. These are things people typically ascribe to God. Well, God camouflages that in the form of humanity, and then turns the world upside down. This is a very different reading than what we've commonly come to expect of what the significance of Jesus' death means to us. One scholar describes it this way: enslavement to God rather than domination over others, it smirks the anti-structure of the alternative household. Like, to be enslaved to God means that we're not going to be enslaved to the ways of power and hierarchy in Jesus' day. It turns them upside down and says that we as followers of Jesus are not going to live in that. And then Jesus says, you should go and emulate this. Become less. That's the ransom that Jesus offers for people to follow. Become like one who becomes enslaved in flesh, who camouflages and tricks, and then turns the powers that be upside down. See, Jesus subverts and inverts the powers of his day. He maps this alternative way of being on top of that. So I want to make it really concrete, okay? Here's today, an example of a trickster. So imagine, some of you will remember where I started before when I sent the kids out, about a youth group, right? So imagine that you're a youth pastor. Imagine that you're a youth pastor with, let's say, 30 or so students. And imagine you're taking your 30 students and the 5 or 6 adults on a mission trip. Where do you guys want to go? Where do you want to go on your mission trip? Anybody? We can go anywhere. Nobody wants to go. This is why I'm not a youth pastor. No one's going to go with me. Where do you want to go? Bali? All right, we're going to Bali, everybody. I'm going to need a map to figure out. All right, you're a youth pastor. 30 kids, 6 adults are with you. You're going on your trip. You have a handful of young people in your group that you're pretty sure they're questioning their own gender identity, their own sexual orientation. You're also abundantly clear that that kind of questioning is not okay at the church where you're the youth pastor. So one way would be to just take on the powers that be. I'm going to advocate for these youth who haven't yet come out, and I am going to tell the pastor how it is how it is. And guess what? If that happens, you're going to be quickly replaced by someone you can assume who's not going to share your subversive values. So what are you going to do? You can try to create safe space for young people to talk about who they are. You can try to talk about ways that God loves and calls each child beloved. What if, as you're getting ready for your mission trip, you could pick any church in Sacramento, which is on the way to Bali, and choose to have your youth stay there overnight? How many churches are in Sacramento? Hundreds? Thousands? You could pick any church. So what if you pick the one that has this huge all-means-all rainbow flag outside, and you roll up in your vans, and you get out of the car, and you don't even park in the parking lot. You park right here in front, so everybody has to walk right past it, because that's clearly where all the vans should park, right? Right on the middle of 8th Street. Get your stuff, kids. Let's go in. Well, what then if a parent or a chaperone who's with you starts to question what you're doing? It was just a church. I just called. Let's see what they're about. And what if you're greeted by somebody who says, "Welcome. Welcome. We're really glad that you found us. We're really glad that you found this. This has become our home. We're an eclectic group of folks. We're an eclectic group of folks who are trying to figure out in all of our stumbling how to pick one another up and to follow in the ways of Jesus. And sometimes we stumble so much it feels like we've fallen down. And sometimes we have a hard time hearing that God calls us beloved, but we keep coming back together to remind ourselves of that. That God is calling each of us a beloved child of God. And what if you're way back? Because if you're going to go to Bali, you got to come back, right? A lot of churches you could stop at in Sacramento. Well, I already made the arrangements. Let's go back to that same one. Let's park our car again in the middle of 8th Street. And let's walk our kids back inside. Maybe God is working through us when that youth pastor dives and doesn't take directly on the powers that be, but says, "I'm going to work with God to figure out how God might communicate belovedness, love, and hope to each and every person that's piled into this van and not getting enough sleep as they make their way on this mission trip." What if God is that kind of a trickster that's subverting all the ways that we think we know, turning them upside down, calling us beloved, and sending us out in the world to do the same? What if? What if?